The work I'm going to talk about is joint work with Benedikt Ponsau and Volker Schumerus. And just to say a few words on the motivation for undertaking this work, I mean, first of all, what one is really after is, of course, brains in the Minkowski and ADS3. But as, Maldacena and Oguri have rather convincingly demonstrated, at least for closed strings, there is a procedure to recover the closed string theory by means of the corresponding Euclidean Wessel-Minowitten models. So this is a kind of analog of the weak rotation, which has been shown to work there. So from this point of view, it seems rather likely that, also for the study of brains in these backgrounds, the Euclidean backgrounds should be a good starting point. And in some sense, it seems obvious that much of the construction of Maldacena Oguri should have a open string counterpart, and so this is part of the motivation. Another part of the motivation is that it seems quite interesting to see what happens to holography in the presence of brains in these backgrounds. So what happens to the famous Maldacena ADS-CFT correspondence. And, the advantage, of course, of this particular background is that one, by means of the exact solvability of the underlying Wessel-Minowitten model, has in principle, full access to stringy corrections. And this is, say, some advantage as compared to other cases where one has discussed holography. Well, and finally, these brains on the Euclidean ADS3 seem to be natural starting points for the investigation or construction of further non-compact conformal field theories on further non-compact backgrounds with boundary, such as the famous Witten SL2 over U1 black hole, or the cigar, or its T-dual, the trumpet. Okay, so much about motivation. The plan of the talk will be, I shall start with a discussion of the geometry of these brains, which basically amounts to studying the semi-classical limit of these brains. Including the discussion on how one could construct or derive the boundary state, which is, say, kind of encoding the coupling to closed strings of these brains in the semi-classical limit. The next step will be, to get some idea on quantum corrections for these boundary states from a factorization constraint. And finally, and this is kind of main focus of today's talk, will be the discussion of what in this non-compact context can replace the Cardy condition, which, say, in the cases of, say, compact backgrounds is the basic consistency condition that one needs to check or to verify when one constructs the couplings of closed strings to these brains. And then, I shall close with a few words of summary and outlook, maybe. Okay, so to start with, let's recall one possible picture of ADS3. Which would be as a solid cylinder where one has, some time running upwards. Radial direction, now it is drawn such that the infinity of ADS3 is here at some finite distance in this particular variable. But, in general, of course, one has to keep in mind that this is just infinity and there's an angular direction. And the weak rotation, which leads me from Minkowski and ADS3 to the Euclidean counterpart, is just the usual one with respect to this particular time variable. And what one gets there, the Euclidean ADS3 is also known as HC+, which is the hyperbolic three space, the space with constant curvature in three dimensions, constant negative curvature. And the convenient model for this space is to realize it as the space of Hermitian 2x2 matrices with determinant 1 and positive trace. And, if one introduces a particular parametrization for these 2x2 matrices, like written down here, then one can write out the metric in a particularly simple form on the space. So what one can see or read off immediately from this form of the metric is that one has a conformal boundary, which corresponds to sending phi to infinity. And as variables of the boundary, I will have gamma and gamma bar, which I can think of as being just like the ZZ bar coordinates one is used to in conformal field theory. One means, so this is the usual map, say, from the cylinder picture that I've drawn to these coordinates in the complex plane that I'm used to in conformal field theory. And finally, it's useful to note that the SL2C symmetry acts in this space. I mean, it's a symmetric space. It has a space. I mean, it has SL2C symmetry. And this acts on the matrices just by multiplication with G, the symmetry group element, from the left, and G dagger from the right. And so that's a bit, say, one feature which makes this H3 plus Wiseman-Witten model little. Oh, thank you. Different in some respects, say in SO2R or compact Wiseman-Witten models, one would have independent left and right actions. Here they are related by Hermitian conjugation, which makes some differences at various places. Okay, so just to get a first idea of the possible brain configurations, one may simply ask which surfaces in H3+ would preserve part of the SO2C symmetry. Because, well, in the end of the day, say at least to construct stable brains, it's some important principle that, preserving symmetry gives at least a good chance to, in the end of the day, get stable brains. So, in this case, the answer to this question, which surfaces would preserve the SO2C symmetry, is rather simple. All of these surfaces can be described by means of an equation of the form trace C, some constant matrix times H, that's the element of H3+, should equal constant. And C, this constant matrix, is basically what parametrizes the different brains that I can put on this space. And there are two main cases to distinguish. One is that the SU2 subgroup of SL2C is preserved. In this case, it turns out that this matrix C must have the form U times U dagger, which is basically equivalent just to saying that by some SL2C transformation, just by some rotation of the brain, it's always possible to map this surface to the surface trace H equals constant. And okay, in the coordinates I'd introduced on the previous transparency, the corresponding equation would read as follows. It's just this. Equation. What you can see here is, in particular, looking at this factor, one sees if one goes to the boundary, which was phi to infinity, then this equation for a finite choose of the constant on the right-hand side can never be satisfied. And this just tells me that these brains are somehow concentrated or localized in the interior. So, well, they're just like squares in the Euclidean ADS 3. This is unlike the other class of surfaces that one can put in this background, which are those preserving the SL2R subgroup of SL2C. In this case, this constant matrix takes the form of, U omega U dagger, so one has some kind of twist element introduced here, which is this matrix omega, which is just some off-diagonal matrix with entries 1 in the off-diagonals. And again, by means of SL2C transformations, one gets rid of the U's here. So the equation defining the brain is trace H times this matrix omega equals constant, and written out in coordinates, one gets this equation of e to the phi gamma plus gamma bar equals to constant. The resulting picture is drawn here on the left. So these are the brains which are, have time translation asymmetries and then are kind of bent in the interior of ADS3. So this would be just the equal time slice, the parameter which parametrizes this class of brains, and this is what, say, plays an important role, of course, in the boundary states and so on. This will be called psi, which kind of measures the distance from, say, the, this point where it is maximally bent away from the surface cutting just right through the middle of ADS3. But I also would like to mention that, of course, one has some liberty now in rotating these brains. And what's maybe interesting to note is that by means of such a rotation, one can also get such a configuration, which upon weak rotation would correspond to a, space-like brain. So also these would come out of these constructions. Okay, so let's discuss the corresponding boundary states in the semi-classical limit. Whether there are brains preserving R2, you mean the group of Euclidean motions in the plane? Yeah, that's a good question. Well, we didn't analyze this possibility, so maybe I should think about it after the seminar and then try to give an answer. Say, just right here, I don't have an answer. So, okay, so for the construction of this semi-classical boundary state, we'll say kind of follow the idea which has appeared in a similar context in the paper of Maldacena, Moore, and Seiberg. Just the idea is the boundary state is supposed to give the amplitude for absorption or emission of a closed string state denoted by psi by the brain. And in the point particle limit, one can consider, in fact, closed string states which are sharply localized, say, at points in H3 plus. So their corresponding wave function would be of the form some delta function in H3 plus. I mean, one has to take into account the measure of H3 plus to if one would want to write it out. Which localizes to a point, say, called H within H3 plus. Now, well, if the closed string state is off the brain, say, at least in this limit that one considers, it just can't get absorbed. And so what this means is that in terms of this, say, basis for the space of states in H3 plus, the boundary state must take the form of a delta function which localizes to where the brain actually sits. Now, this is, of course, not quite what one wants for doing, well, string theory or conformal field theory in these backgrounds. There one is used to have bases in the space of states where one diagonalizes, say, the L0 operator, which here would just correspond to the Laplacian. So one just has to do basically the Fourier transform from these bases where one has point-like localization to eigen functions of the Laplacian. So we need to write out the complete set of eigenstates of the Laplacian in this background, and that's given by states which will be denoted J, U, and U bar, where J, say it's a little funny, but say it turns out to be useful, is taking values on these kind of shifted imaginary line, shifted by some amount of minus 1/2. And the corresponding wave functions are written just out here. Looks a bit unusual, but say these are just like the plane waves that one is used to now for H3 plus. So what this means is this is the, well, the boundary state in the basis of eigenstates of the L0 operator. This I can read off if I just do the expansion of this delta function boundary state with respect to this class of eigenstates of the Laplacian. So if I manage to write this delta function as some integral over J and over U, which were the parameters parametrizing the eigenstates of the Laplacian in such a form, well, then what appears here as a coefficient, this is what I want. This is just the expression for the boundary state in the wanted basis. Okay, so just what I'm saying is, one can read off the semi-classical expression for the boundary state from some basically well-defined mathematical exercise which is doing the Fourier transform of this delta function. And, well, although it's not completely trivial, say, small exercise in harmonic analysis, what one finds in the end of the day takes the following form. For the SL2R-preserving brains, one gets such a dependence on U plus U bar, absolute value to the power 2J, and the kind of interesting piece, I mean, this is basically just given by, well, the SL2R symmetry. The more interesting piece, which is where really the parameter which parameterizes the different brains enters, is this here. So there one has a kind of plain wave-like expression. In fact, if 2 j plus 1 for j's taking these values is, of course, just imaginary, so it is really like a plain wave. However, there's a little interesting, say, subtlety in here. This expression jumps according to the sign of u plus u bar. So, well, there's a sign change up here. And that's quite important in the end. Okay, and the same story or the same exercise can be carried out for the SU2 preserving brains, where one does not have such a jump. It can't be there because this expression here, well, here the jump in the for the SO2R preserving brains can be there because this expression gets singular at u plus u bar equals to 0. This expression does not have a singularity anywhere, so that's just how it comes out to be. Okay, so that's already giving some good hints on what the boundary state will look like. But now, of course, the main point is to look for stringy corrections to these expressions. And in order to do this, I shall briefly go through some basic features or some basic points concerning the H3 plus Weissmann-Witten model. So first of all, well, one should note that the spectrum is organized as usual by current algebras with generators J A of Z and J bar A of, should be Z bar, of course, with level K. So these are basically just, yeah, the usual SL2 current algebras. And these can be seen to be some extension of the classical SL2C symmetry that one had on these backgrounds. The spectrum decomposes as a direct integral of representation. So one has a continuous spectrum of representations in the spectrum, where again this S denotes this shifted imaginary line that we had encountered before. In fact, it should be plus here, and this is of some importance. Yeah, and what are these representations? These are current algebra representations which are almost generated as usual, except for a slightly different zero-mode representation. Namely, the zero-mode representation is neither of lowest nor highest weight type. Instead, well, one may parametrize it by means of these states J, U, U bar, which were taking just complex values that we had encountered before. And the action of the zero modes on these, say, basis states is realized by means of differential operators instead of matrices that one knows from, say, SU2 Weissmann-Witten. So, well, the differential operators here, they depend, of course, on the choice of the zero mode generators, and they are written out here on the right. And, okay, this zero mode representation is then extended to a full current algebra representation in more or less usual fashion. Namely, one demands that the positive modes of the current algebra annihilate the zero mode subspace, and then one generates all other states by acting with a JA with negative, well, moding indices on the zero mode space. Okay, so the corresponding primary fields which create these zero mode, the states in the zero mode subspace, they will be denoted phi J with, depending on variables U and Z. So it's the same U which enters in here, which is kind of just our analog to the M and M bar indices that we would have in SU2. And then the OPE defining them as primary fields is basically the standard one, where one just replaces the matrices by these differential operators with respect to U. And semi-classically, one can think of them as just being obtained by these plane waves that we had on the previous transparency by replacing the coordinates by the corresponding fields in the Weissmann-Witten model. That's basically all what happens, but of course, such a representation one cannot expect to be valid in the quantum theory due to normal ordering and whatever quantum corrections there will be. Conformal dimensions here are given by this expression, 1 minus 1 over k minus 2 j times j plus 1. And what's finally worth noting for the, well, following transparency is that there's a particular primary field where I set j equals to 1/2, which is related to the fundamental matrix-valued field H, which occurs in the action of the Westman-Witten model, just as follows. So I can expand phi 1 half, say, with respect to u and u bar. So then this expansion can be written in such a matrix form. So it's just a quadratic form defined by the matrix H, which is equivalent to saying that this field phi 1 half satisfies two second order differential equations with respect to u, namely just that the second derivatives with respect to u and u bar just vanish. So this is basically just a, well, useful way of parametrizing or recovering the basic field of the theory in this notation for the primary fields. Okay, so concerning now the method to determine the stringy corrections or to get some idea concerning the stringy directions in the boundary states, I shall be a little brief here. It's just some technical story, but I shall try to give you the basic idea that one uses. Namely, what one considers is the factorization of two-point functions in the presence of the boundary. And one of these operators that are involved will be taken to be the special one that we had just discussed, which is basically just the basic field H of the theory. And of course, well, there are two ways to factorize this by doing OPEs or by factorizing this in over intermediate states. The first is to do the OPE just in the bulk between these two operators. And this is written down here. It takes the form as we've written it. Well, there are just the usual terms coming from conformal symmetry. Then there's some term determined by SL2R symmetry. There are two terms in the sum, which just basically reflects the fusion rules, which come from the second order differential equation of the field phi 1 half that we had discussed before. And well, these coefficients enter as the operator product coefficients. But as it is well known, there's a second way of factorizing such an amplitude, which is basically by sending the operators to the boundary and exploiting the existence of some operator product expansion of these bulk operators when they go to the boundary. So they can be expanded as a sum over boundary operators, which are the operators creating the, well, basically open string states in the open string channel. And this takes a very similar form. So if one sends phi 1 half to the boundary, one has an expression with some, well, singular terms in the z-dependence, some OPE coefficients. And OK, what's important here is that this produces in one channel the unity identity operator on the boundary. And this is what is just, yeah, what is exploited technically in the argument. Now, what one can see if one does this operator product expansion, well, here, the one written here, this expression is rewritten as a sum over one-point functions, where one has, well, it just takes the one-point function of the operator here appearing on the right. And what appears here are shifts of this label J by plus or minus one-half. So this expresses in terms of the one-point function with shifted parameters. And well, on the other hand, if one does this other limit and basically in this channel just gets the unity operator, what one will get then from the second operator which is hanging around is just the one-point function at the unshifted label of J. So if one compares the expressions one gets from these two channels, one gets some functional equation, some equation relating the differences of the arguments J for the boundary state. And this one can study and analyze and look for solutions. And yeah, that's what then leads or, say, suggests the following expressions. So one should maybe be careful and say really what is written above here, namely that the following expressions are what one could find or single out as the most natural solutions of the factorization constraint of these functional equations that we discussed just before, which are also, say, reproducing the correct semi-classical limit. So first of all, for the ADS2 brains, one finds the following expression, which is independently found by Lee, Uguri, and Park. which is, okay, the usual z-dependent term, the term that we had seen before determined by SL2R symmetry. And then there's some non-trivial factor appearing, which just depends on J and not on the boundary condition. So this is kind of reflecting some, well, measure part, which does show stringy correction. So, well, what I should have said, something to write, well, maybe I just say it in words. This parameter B squared is just a different notation for the level. So B squared would correspond to 1 over k minus 2. So level to infinity, which is the semi-classical limit, corresponds to b to 0. And one easily sees that one just recovers unity in this limit. So then this factor just disappears. And this is what we had seen in the semi-classical limit as the non-trivial, say, connection between the parameter parameterizing the different brains and the J parameter and this funny jump appearing in this expression. And similarly, for the spherical brains, one finds also such an expression where basically, yeah, what just happens is that one takes the semi-classical expression and replaces this kind of J-dependent, purely J-dependent measure factor by the same as we had up here. And yeah, okay, what one should stress is, this was first found by Givion, Kutalov, and Schwimmer. And yeah, what I want to stress is that these solutions are by no means unique, well, because periodic function with respect to these shifts by 1/2 would be perfectly consistent with these functional equations. So one definitely needs further constraints to narrow down, to really exhibit these as the proper one-point functions that we've been looking for. And this, of course, should be something like the Cardy condition, which is, of course, the fundamental consistency condition that we have to satisfy. That's what we want to discuss next. So, well, just to recall what the Cardy condition is about, it's just worldsheet duality. So one considers the amplitude, for some closed string being emitted by one brain, absorbed by another, which I can evaluate, which I can write out as, some amplitude in closed string theory, where the brain is represented by a boundary state, the time evolution running here to the right by the closed string Hamiltonian or the Hamiltonian of the model with periodic boundary conditions. And this is then sandwiched again against the boundary state representing the other brain. And this by worldsheet duality should be equivalent just to a open string one loop diagram or a trace over the Hilbert space of the open string theory or the Wesselmann-Witten model with boundary conditions. And the trouble here in this case is that the left-hand side and as well, of course, then the right-hand side diverges in the case of the ADS2 brains, which is not too surprising. I mean, one has infinite volume and target space, and this generically leads to divergences. But the whole story now is really to be careful in the treatment of these divergences and to extract some meaningful information from these, a priori ill-defined amplitudes. Okay, so if one then just writes out this annulus amplitude over here by summing over a complete set of intermediate states, what one would get is an expression of the following type. So one should first sum over descendants. So the dependence of the boundary state on the descendants is just, represented here by introducing such a label I for the descendants. And this is kind of trivial. The sum over descendants just gives some factor q to the b squared p squared and an eta to the minus 3, which is so simple due to the fact that we're considering current algebra representations which are non-degenerate. So they're just equivalent to free field representations. So, well, they're three free fields which appear, so there's some eta to the minus 3 here. More interesting, then, is the summation over zero-mode subspace of Rj, and that's where the first divergent appears, and we just introduce a cut of lambda here, so it's kind of boring divergence. It's just like, well, if I cut off, say, the summation at some boundary lambda, then the result will be just proportional to lambda. And, well, but these were non-trivial expressions. And so if one just writes it out, what one finds is some density, an annulus, which depends on P, and the brains, which were in the game. And finally, one has to sum over the set of representations appearing in the spectrum. And also there is some divergence which appears, which I have to cut off at the lower end. So I introduce some length here, cutting off the integral at the lower end. And that's the two cutoffs that I need. I mean, that's definitely then the one which is more interesting in the end. And okay, if one just then puts the pieces together, one finds, say, after having cut off the things in this way, an expression of the following form. One has this integral over P, one has the characters, and one has the spectral density for the annulus, which takes the following form. So I've absorbed this lambda cutoff in this expression for convenience. There's some constants which are not interesting, and that's the non-trivial interesting part, which is also where the dependence on the brain parameters, which was psi zero, is contained in. And just to see how it diverges at the lower end of this P integration, one may note, okay, that this expression goes like 1 over P squared when I send P to 0. And yeah, so that's how it diverges. And what's, say, useful to observe or important to observe is that this divergence itself is universal. It does not carry any dependence or information on the boundary state. Okay, just to repeat, if you wish, the last words, the kind of structure of the divergences with respect to this cutoff L is of the following form. There are constants, and then it diverges like L, so like a volume, and then there's a finite part, and we just stressed it is the volume divergence is universal. So, yeah, really what one needs to do is to extract something non-trivial, which will be the finite part here. And a way to do it is the following. One can just subtract away this divergence by comparing the annulus amplitude to the annulus amplitude with a fixed reference boundary condition. I mean, okay, so one compares to some reference brain, which still, of course, gives me the relevant information on how this quantity changes when I change the brain. And okay, then I can do the usual story I would do in the Cardi game. I would do the modular transformation, which is quite simple here. It's basically just Fourier transform. And if I put the things together, what I found then is the expression for the amplitude in the open string channel is the following. So here are the characters for the open string channel, and here I find some different spectral density for this open string channel, and it takes this particular form, which looks a bit complicated. So there's some strange special function appearing here, and the expression is some logarithmic derivative. It's useful just with hindsight to write it in this way, of a ratio of these special functions. And what appears here, okay, can be represented by this integral representation, which is just what you would straightforwardly obtain along the lines I've sketched. And well, but that's some rather interesting special function. In fact, I mean, I should not go too much into it, but it is, say, known also under the name of quantum dye logarithm. It was introduced by Fadeev and Kashaf, but Voronovich has introduced it for quantum group motivations. It's kind of universal building block in these non-compact CFTs like Liouville theory, H3+, and so on. So it's not very, from this point of view, it's not very surprising that it appears here. Okay, so this was basically how we went coming from the closed string channel. And now, of course, to make a real check, we should compare to something from, say, intrinsically determined in the open string channel. Otherwise, I would not have checked anything. Okay, so let's go back to the point particle limit, but now for the open strings, basically. And in the point particle limit, the Hamiltonian, say, in the open string channel, would go to the Laplacian on the brain. And if I write it out in suitable coordinates, and what suitable coordinates means is just I introduce a variable chi, which kind of runs across this brain, and the variable nu here, which appears, is just a reparametrization of these global time coordinates. So that's the two coordinates which I need to parametrize each point on the brain. And written out in these coordinates, I get an expression which is fairly simple. And of course, I can do a Fourier transformation with respect to this new variable. So then I get a differential operator with respect to a single variable only. And well, one can also get rid of this linear term just by splitting off some simple function of this chi variable. So basically, what we have to deal with is Liouville quantum mechanics. So h equals p squared plus e to the 2q, so just the exponential interaction. And it's pretty clear what the physics of this quantum mechanics is. Namely, one can send in wave packets just free, I mean, superpositions of plane waves from this infinity where the interaction has disappeared. They will move in, will ultimately get reflected out, and and will appear, say, kind of redistributed the plane waves out here in this asymptotic region. So what this means then in terms of ADS2 brains is that the reflection, the potential here with respect to this variable will correspond to the reflection of signals which I sent from the boundary of the brain at infinity in the interior. So I send this in, this will ultimately be scattered back and reach the boundary. And that's what kind of is encoded in this quantum mechanical exercise. Okay, so let's maybe recall what in the presence of continuous spectrum in a quantum mechanical problem was really the trouble with the definition of partition functions. I mean, how would we get the corresponding divergences that we had seen in the closed string channel? Well, okay, first, just again, if one has some general potential quantum mechanical system with a potential V of Q, the, say, in terms of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, the story that I just sketched is just, okay, eigenstates of the Hamiltonian will consist of an incoming plane wave and some outgoing plane wave, which is just, well, P get reflected into its negative, and what it picks up is a phase factor. And this is really where all the interesting information is in, namely, this is kind of what encodes, for example, the full structure of the potential, if the potential is nice enough. So this is really important. This reflection amplitude, the e to the I, this phase shift is really the important player here in the game. Okay, and then one finds that in such a situation, something like these traces will always diverge. Let's recall why and how. And in order to see this easily, one just may put a wall here at some large value of L to the right of the potential, to the left of the potential. And if L is large enough, one may represent wave functions near the wall by their asymptotic behavior, which was, well, again, ingoing plane wave plus outgoing plane wave with the phase shift. And the quantization condition in this case would be, okay, psi should vanish at the wall. And this, say, in this asymptotic region, I can write out as some condition just involving the reflection amplitude. So this will be the quantization condition which determines me the discrete spectrum of values of P that I will get. Okay, so what this says is that, okay, if I have my wall far enough out, it is really just this reflection amplitude which determines me the spectrum. So that's the basic link between spectral data and scattering data. And well, just with, say, three lines of calculation from this quantization condition, what one finds for the spectral density in this game, so the, number of eigenvalues per energy interval, is falling. Well, one gets this volume divergent, which is completely universal, is completely independent of the potential. And one gets a finite piece, which is then given by this reflection amplitude, and it turns out to be just the logarithmic derivative of it. So Yeah, this is then, of course, what we're ultimately after. This is what we want to compare with the spectral density which we get from the closed string channel. Oops. But first, we need to return to the real thing, namely go from the quantum mechanical toy model to the full Wessermann-Witten theory. So we need to discuss a bit the spectrum of the H3 plus Wessermann-Witten model on the strip, or, well, if I wish, on the upper half plane, with boundary conditions corresponding to these ADS2 brains. And, well, if one writes out the corresponding first order action or Hamiltonian, turns out that as in the closed string case, that the Walshit theory becomes free near the boundary. So there it's quite easy to, well, classify or specify eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And, well, the main thing to discuss is, of course, then the boundary condition for the corresponding free fields that one gets. And from the picture, it's pretty easy to guess what this will be. Say there will be Neumann-type boundary conditions for the coordinate corresponding to tau. Maybe it's not quite as obvious, but it turns out to be the case that there's also Neumann-type boundary condition. I mean, asymptotically, I should stress, for this phi coordinate and for the angular coordinate theta, there's a Dirichlet boundary condition. What this means is that the corresponding theory which I would obtain by quantizing the free field theory, I get asymptotically, throwing away the interactions which encode the non-trivial, say, well, curvature in ADS3. This Hilbert space would be of this particular form. There's some zero-mode part. Well, basically, of course, I have zero modes for the Neumann-type coordinates, so there's some phi 0 and some tau. Well, I should have maybe put a tau 0 here, and one has some L2 of R cross R for these zero modes. And then there's a Fock space for the non-zero modes. And this can be decomposed in terms of current algebra representations. In fact, maybe I should have used a different letter here. These are not the same as the ones we've seen before, but rather they're open string versions where one just has SL2R symmetry instead of SL2C. Anyway, okay, so this decomposition is obtained by noting that the zero mode space can be decomposed with respect to the SL2R symmetry acting on the zero modes in terms of some direct integral of SL2R principal series representations. This is what is appearing in here. And this is extended to a decomposition of the full, say, current algebra representation. Well, basically by applying more or less standard free field construction with, say, this slight peculiarity of with respect to the zero modes. So this is what gives this decomposition into kind of representations which are generated from principal series of SL2R. And again, one will find here in the full, say, stringy corrected theory, a complete reflection in the interior of ADS3. So this can be encoded again in writing out the asymptotics of the wave function representing some eigenstate parametrized by J and U as previously in terms of these zero mode variables phi 0 and tau. Namely, one would have then this ingoing plane wave with some delta function which kind of just tells that the open string state was emitted at the point parametrized by U at the boundary, which is just a time axis basically. And then there's the outgoing plane wave. The U dependence has been a little bit mixed up, but this part is just given by SL2R symmetry. So what you, those who know would, will recognize here is the expression for the SL2R, for the kernel of the SL2R intertwining operator, which generates the equivalence of representations with index J and with index minus J minus 1. So it is well known that these two representations are just unitarily equivalent, and the kernel which realizes this equivalence is just what appears here. So this factor is just normalizing it such that it becomes unitary. And finally, and this is what we're after, there's this reflection amplitude appearing here. And, well, We can then just go through basically the same arguments as before to be led to the conclusion that this reflection amplitude will determine the spectral density on the strip by means of its logarithmic derivative. And okay, here I have this ratio of terms just coming from this regularization where I throw away the volume divergence. Okay, so we have shifted the task of calculating the spectral density to the task of calculating the reflection amplitude. And okay, I can probably not really go into too much of detail here, but I can certainly give the basic idea underlying this calculation. First of all, one may observe that these asymptotics, which we just discussed, implies that the operators which would create this state must satisfy a reflection property. So the operator creating this state labeled by J and U is linearly dependent from the operator, say, corresponding to the same SL2R, to the equivalent SL2R principal series representation, which has index minus J minus 1. What appears here is this unitary SL2R intertwining operator, which is just integral operator with this kernel here. And there's the reflection amplitude which appears in front. So this is just, it's nothing but, say, kind of reformulation of this reflection property in terms of operators creating the open string states. Now, the second observation that one uses is that there is a simple OPE between a generic such operator and a boundary and a special spin 1 boundary field, which will be, well, just psi 1 of U2. This, in fact, is a close relative to this field phi 1 half we had encountered before, which was related to this matrix valued fundamental field. Basically, this is what I just get when sending it to the boundary. So again, it's something which satisfies differential equations and therefore has a finite set of terms appearing in OPEs, their fusion rules. So in this case, well, this will be a third order differential equation satisfied by this guy. And so I get three terms here on the right hand side of the OPE. And I have the corresponding OPE coefficients being introduced here in front, which now depend on the brain variable, on the brain parameter. Okay, and now one just needs to combine or compare the reflection property and this OPE. Basically, one can just do the game of first reflecting and then doing OPE or the other way around and compare what one gets. And this gives some non-trivial relationship between the reflection amplitude and this E minus coefficient. And well, if one just works it out, one gets this relatively simple equation. It's again a functional equation where one has shifts of J by plus or minus 1/2. And what appears as a coefficient on the right-hand side is this special OPE coefficient E minus. And as it is the OPE coefficient of a degenerate field, I do have a reasonable chance to just calculate it by exploiting properties of this degenerate field. And that's then the task that we have. Maybe here the remark one should make, unlike the previous case where I'd stressed that these difference equations in general do not have unique solutions, they might be multiplied by periodic functions, I mean functions periodic in this shift of plus minus 1/2. Here, say, if I have given E minus, this will only have a unitary solution as soon as I require this to be really a unitary object. This is what eliminates the ambiguity, say, by multiplying with periodic functions, one can show. So in this case, really, well, knowing this reflection amplitude is equivalent to knowing E minus. Okay, and finally, this is really what I do not want to bother you with. It is possible to just calculate E minus by carefully evaluating Cardy-Llewellyn consistency conditions. Basically, one just, again, does the game of starting with, say, 1/2 primary field, generic primary field in the bulk, and analyzes, again, the condition from OPE, and one exploits associativity of boundary operators. There's a little, I mean, just to make it tractable. There's a little trick which is useful and maybe interesting in its own right, namely one finds that this guy can be expressed in terms of fusion coefficients of this Wessamine-Witten model. So these kind of relations that were found in many, say, rational contexts seem to work also here, but with a little shift. In fact, one does not have an identification between the parameters which would correspond to the brains and the parameters which correspond to the spectrum, but it is shifted by just some amount depending on the level. So it's slightly funny and curious, say, from the general point of view developing some formalism for treating these theories in a general context, it's probably quite some interesting hint for the future. Anyway. Okay, so I'm coming close to the end. So what we have now is two independent means to calculate the spectral density for the strip. I mean, one was to go from the annulus and doing the modular transformation. The other was via the calculation of the reflection amplitude. And what we find is a perfect agreement. So these expressions just match perfectly. And, well, so this indeed gives a rather non-trivial check for the consistency or for the correctness of the expression for this boundary state. And this, maybe it's worth stressing again that, say, if one had just looked at this part which diverges like the volume, which one could have done as well, of course, then this yields just a rather weak constraint because, well, it did not contain any dependence with respect to the boundary conditions at all. So I really think that in order to do a proper job here, if one wants to calculate these boundary states, one has to go through this work of calculating reflection amplitude in such quantities. Okay, so I come to the conclusions and maybe some outlook questions. So we believe that we have learned something on the construction of brains on such non-compact backgrounds. There were a couple of qualitatively new issues that arose due to the non-compactness, and, well, we find it particularly interesting to see what happened to the Cardi-Valinda story in this context. Really, what one should maybe stress, well, in the Cardi-Valinda context, one has, in the place of the spectral density, just these fusion rule coefficients, Nij of k. Now one finds a somewhat, well, in some respects, somewhat more interesting object on its place, and I think it should give some valuable hints for setting up some general formalism to treat such conformal field theories. Well, actually, yeah, this is what I was kind of hinting at. Well, at the moment, of course, I cannot offer any theory of this kind which would replace the full Valinda story. What is, also in this context, it's a little more complicated. One can compare maybe to the case of Liouville theory, where one can also observe that the boundary state has a rather interesting structure, because it looks almost like what one would get from this Cardi business, like related to the modular transformation matrix. So it also appears in this formula. What also appears is some phase, basically related to the closed string story of the reflection. So this somehow has to be there to account for this reflection property that one just has in the closed string channel. And furthermore, what is of course the most interesting part is to see what happens to this denominator, which would be related to the Q dimension or this S0J. And what appears there is quite interesting, namely it turns out to be the Plancher measure for the corresponding quantum group. So in a way, it's the most natural counterpart that one could hope for in a non-compact context because, well, after all, this say, in a quantum group context, this Q dimension, one way maybe to get it is just to get it as the weight with which, say, a completeness sum would be weighted. And in a non-compact context, this is just the Plancher measure. And, well, so at the moment, what I have is just the phenomenological observation that this is how it comes out to be. But definitely, it's necessary to try to do a real theory, I mean, to develop this into a real theory. Okay, so, well, then the remark I wanted to make is that our results will pave the way for a study of brains in backgrounds such as the Witten black hole, SO2 over U1, and we're presently investigating this, and it looks like really at least some interesting class of brains can be just constructed starting from the brains that we have described by more or less, by coset constructions. And well, maybe let's end with some questions which may or may not be interesting to look at for further research, which are kind of raised by our results. First of all, I stress this funny jump that I have in the one-point function. So, I don't know, I was wondering what this would mean in terms of the space-time CFT. I mean, of course, somehow one would expect a jump to be created by such a brain somehow, but if I think of the space-time CFT in terms of some symmetric product or something like this, it's not quite clear what parameters in the symmetric product would change from one half to the other. So is this some moduli? It seems unlikely that it could be the central charge, for example. So I just, well, would be curious to know what this is. And furthermore, one thing I didn't discuss, but which I should have stressed maybe earlier, is that up to now we have not managed to discuss the case that there are two different brains in the same background. And in fact, going through this game that we played, one can prove that there is not a unitary reflection amplitude if one has not, well, either only a single brain or two brains with symmetric values of the bending parameter. So this is, of course, rather strange, and one wonders, well, whether this is a real problem being indicated there, or well, I mean, say in this formalism, certainly, of course, we try to make the point pretty clear that really this is unavoidable conclusion. However, one way out we did not study so far, and that's probably the most natural one, and that's probably what one should look at, is in a way what we were doing in this kind of formalism would be just to consider strings which stretch from brain A to brain B. It would be rather natural, as the two brains would always meet at the boundary, to assume that there might be some mixing, for example, between the sectors of strings going from A to B and from B to A, so that one would make as ansatz for the open string Hilbert space just the direct sum of these two Hilbert spaces. So there is certainly some room to kind of cure this this problem, but, well, I mean, it's something that definitely needs to be looked into further. So, okay, so basically that's what I want to say. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
So you mentioned early on this other paper by Juan and Nadi Cyber.
Right.
Else. Remind me, were they considering just these zero brains? They were also looking at brains. And
yeah, no, they weren't. They were considering, first of all, the compact counterpart of this story, which is SU2 and the corresponding cosets. Yeah, yeah. But they did not only the zero brains, they also did, these brains for having conjugacy classes and so on. Yeah, I think this sounds very nice. I'm quite hungry now. Thanks. I hope it was some use. Oh. Okay, nice to meet you. Yeah.
So I guess, I mean, ADS, if you have ADS cross S3, you have brains that sort of become wrap on both.
Yeah.
That would be kind of a richer, more complicated problem, and that would, you probably wouldn't have really new ingredients. I mean, the...
Oh, right.
Once you've done one non-compact case, that's
right.
Going to be some elaboration.
Exactly. So this would be, I mean, the building blocks are all there, and one would just need to assemble them by taking tensor products, basically,
right.
Yeah.
Now, the limit that corresponds to giant gravitons, right, those are brains that are sort of supposed to be moving, supposed to be moving rapidly around the S3. I don't know if there's some way you can study this here. I'm not sure what the precise question is.
Yeah,
I mean, also,
yeah.
You can have questions like, everybody's doing GP wave limits now.
Well, I say kind of personally, what would I find probably, say, one of the more interesting directions now is then really go to this Witten black hole.
That was interesting, 10 years ago, and we kind of got stuck on the CFT side because we didn't have the right concept.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we understand, I guess, what the CFT is,
since there's a lot of relations between this and that, there are these constructions of getting this black hole from having NS5 brains somehow distributed, for example, around one circle to regularize the throat that you would get a la Kellen, Harvey, Strominger, and...
Right.
One could hope, for example, to learn something about the corresponding gauge theories. I mean, this I understand, for example, is Kutazov's interest in the matter. And, what probably I would find extremely interesting is if one, in this context, could go Minkowskian. But this is also, probably still more challenging technically, so there I don't...
S L bar plus S L bar.
Yeah, but say SL2R with a Witten model, say in a way still we control only rather indirectly. Because I mean what Maldacena Oguri taught us is how to construct a string theory involving this piece in the background via some kind of weak rotation. And then you could say, okay, I can vary the meta part as I like. So in principle I can deduce from this the spectrum of what should be the spectrum of SL2R proper. But SL2R proper not under any control so far. It's the Euclidean story which is under good technical control, and this is and only very indirectly you can kind of say, it tells us something about SL2R, and that's the problem. So this is, the way I would probably look at it is to look at the possible weak rotations one could do, say, from the CFT side. So.